I'm here at Emporium doing one of my favourite things, which is talking to people who make great theatre. And it's even more exciting because I think a dress rehearsal has just taken place. I'm here with Simon David Eden, who is the director and lots of other things, but particularly the writer of The Albatross, Third and Main. And this is going to go live for a couple of weeks here at Emporium. So my first question, Simon, is how did this get written? Give me the sort of, right from the moment of, this is going to be a play.
Oh, wow. Okay, the seed of the idea. I lived in the States for a time. I've spent a lot of time on the East Coast. I lived on the West Coast, but spent a lot of time on the Eastern Seaboard. And last time I was there, I discovered a piece of federal law that's enshrined in the U.S. Constitution to do with eagles, protection of golden eagles. And the further I kind of delved into it, I was just really intrigued about how that impacted on the indigenous Native Americans who use the eagle. It's a very important part of their culture, their ceremonies, rites of passage. And when I discovered that you had to be a federally approved tribe in order to access even feathers, that it was a federal offense to be in possession of a feather, and you could do a year in prison and receive a very hefty couple hundred thousand dollar fine, that was kind of the seed of the idea. I wanted to explore that in more depth. And it was an unusual one for me because it actually, that was the beginning point. But there were several other elements which, when the three were combined, they gave me the idea for the play. Samuel Taylor Coleridge's Rime of the Ancient Mariner, that poem. Coleridge was, I discovered completely about a year earlier, had done a speech in Bristol in 1796, I think I'm right in saying. He was talking about the evils of slavery, and what was really interesting, I mean, of course, for a poet philosophy of that time, that's not surprising in itself. But what really struck me is his guilt by association of living in a society that was profiting from it. He lived in Bristol, and so that gave me a maritime feeling. And then Massachusetts, where the first settlers arrived and began to trade with Native Americans, suddenly I was putting these two things together. So who knows where creativity comes from, where ideas really come from. In this case, somehow, for some reason, those two things fused in my mind, as did my curiosity and interest in Native American sculptures, back in the day what were called cigar store Indians, which actually now many Native Americans find is quite an offensive image, which is why actually there's one in the play. We have a replica standing on stage which represents that. So now I had three pieces of a puzzle. And as I say, why those things fuse and become the basis for a stage play, I don't know, but what it did mean for me as a British writer is suddenly here was a very American subject. It couldn't be said anywhere else. Because many people have said to me, so what's a British writer doing writing an American play? There are precedents, Enron, you know, Lucy Preble's Enron and Dave Eggers' plays. For me, I wouldn't have set out necessarily to set a play in America, but because of this piece of legislation, it couldn't have been set anywhere else.
And when you've got those pieces of the puzzle, is it at the stage then where you want to write it, or it's a compulsion?
It's a very, good point. It is a compulsion. It is. I create something every day, whether it's scribbling down a line, whether it's scribbling down a lyric, making a piece of art. I am compelled to make things. I love the form of plays, because unlike, I'm also a screenwriter, and I have a novel out, second novel out this year. But there's something very, very special about the form of the play. I think because it's driven by dialogue, largely, it's once I get into allow those characters in my head to begin to have a conversation, they lead me to places I didn't necessarily expect to go. I know what the beginning point is and I know what the end point is, but more often than not, when I write stage plays, the characters dictate where we go in between. And
so as a man who's a screenwriter and has also written a novel, why did it go down the route of a play and not one of the other, you know, ways of presenting work?
That's a very good question. Again, when ideas occur to me, they seem to suggest the form that they will take really early on. I've never embarked on a project and thought, actually, I've chosen the wrong media for this. This should be a play. This should be a film. This should be television, radio. They always emerge, knowing what they are, and I just follow that lead, follow my instinct. Really, it's a very instinctive process for me. It's not actually an intellectual process. It's a very instinctive one.
So Simon David Eden, writer. Simon David Eden, director. How do those two people get on with each other?
This is actually, although I've directed for the screen, this is my first professional directing for the theatre. The late, great Fred Zinnemann, director, gave me some very good advice when I was a kid. I was very lucky to have him as a mentor for a time. He said, surround yourself with good people. And that's exactly what I've done with this. Our stage management are fantastic. My cast are just absolutely sizzling and brilliant. My producer is wonderful. And they've enabled me to feel comfortable going into the space and embarking on a new, very new venture for me. Directing for the stage is a very different thing. What I chose to do very on, it was a very definite choice, was to sort of leave the writer at the door initially for the first couple of weeks of rehearsals and be the director in the room. I don't know whether the guys would remark on this, but I never had my nose in the script. I know there are many stage directors who do, even if they're not writers. I chose very deliberately to put the script down and work with what was in front of me.
That suggests, and I'm not saying you're old, but you're not 20, that, you know, you need a bit of self-discipline to be able to do that.
Yes, I think that's true. And you need, I cast it, so I knew who I was working. Obviously, I hadn't worked with these guys before. Charlie, I knew from a rehearsal reading of something from a year ago, but I didn't know the other guys at all. We saw about 35 people for these three parts. So I knew the caliber of the actor that I was going to be in the room with, and that also helped enormously. I had a plan. I think it's always crucial that you have a plan to fall back on. But what I wanted to do is give them enormous latitude to play, to explore, I kept referring back to film references, actually, perhaps naturally. And initially I was quite worried that they as experienced theatre makers themselves might not approve of. And then I discovered that Tennessee Williams actually was inspired by films. I bought a play of his called The Fugitive Kind, very early play. That was inspired by a film by Maxwell Anderson called Winterset. Not the plot, but his experience of what the mood and the atmosphere of the movie was. And it was a Bogart film too that inspired that. And so I was able to kind of bring that experience of noir and so on into the rehearsal space. And the actors seem to enjoy that. I would say I'm not precious about my words. I did say at the outset, we're not going to tear this script up and come up with a different play. But if you feel a line would read better some other way, if you feel there's a moment that the stage direction is not what you would do instinctively, let's explore that. Let's be open to that. We've always got this plan, this script, these stage directions that are written down to come back to, but I want to see where you guys take this. And I'm very pleased I did. And I certainly wouldn't approach, I would love to direct again for the theater. I wouldn't approach it any differently than I have. Although again, maybe the guys would say, about this element of what you do. I don't know. It's been a fantastic experience. I think we have a wonderful play that I'm very excited about. I'm very proud of the work that we've created together in that room. And I can't wait to share it with an audience.
And in terms of the writer at the door then, did you sort of go out of the rehearsal room in those early weeks and then say to the writer, that scene's too long, we need to cut that? I mean, what was... I'm just interested in when writers are either in or they're not. And when I've done interviews, they've said, we really regret having the writer in, or the writer has been brilliant. He was there in the front row. He's very flexible. He even wrote things in the rehearsal room. So what was that dialogue between writer and director that improved the work?
That's a really interesting insight and a very interesting thing to explore. For me, I was able to take what we had experienced in the room and go back to the script and say, actually, that piece of blocking that the guys came up with, or that stage direction I had there, if we played that half a page earlier, it makes much more sense of these lines that follow. So it was completely organic for me. There was never a point that I was tearing my hair out and thinking this doesn't work. It all worked. It was nuancing. And so the writer in me was able to say, well, actually, I've just seen that work and it's better than what I did. And I will always, again, it's a Zinnemann thing. Joffe was another one who I spent some time with early on. You know, if you've got smart people in the room and they're coming up with great ideas, steal them, you know, steal from the best. Why wouldn't you listen to them, you know? So for me as the writer, and this has impacted, Samuel French are publishing this play, and right up until certainly 2 weeks into rehearsals, whilst they were prepping the playtext for publication, I was sending additional notes saying, this great thing's happened. I need to change this. Do you mind if I just add this? I want this to be in the published text because it has honed and refined and polished what I gave you originally. And they were great and very supportive and did that. And that was, for me, the real value of directing this thing. I would say, if you have the opportunity as a writer, if you only get one opportunity as a writer to direct your own work, seize it and do it. I'm sure that won't work for everybody. Some people, you know, perhaps wouldn't ever want to. But I've learned an enormous amount about my own work with this play from being in the room and working with a great team.
Kind of a little challenging question to maybe round up with, which is, I met my first directors last year at the Edinburgh Fringe who don't do dress rehearsals. And actually one said, as a kind of film reference, that would be like showing the film for the first time with nobody in the cinema, you know, apart from the guys that have made it. I think the spirit behind it was, it's almost like, what does it achieve to do a dress rehearsal? So most people do. So you've just come out of a dress rehearsal. There isn't an audience in there, but I guess there are various people in there, including yourself. What does that do for the piece? Now you're going to go live tonight and you've done a dress rehearsal.
Again, very good question, and very specifically, it's to do with the technical. In this instance, the guys were great, and you know, there were a few little bumps here and there, but that's good from a dress rehearsal point of view. But so from a performance take on it, it was just useful for them to run through it. From a technical aspect, very specifically, we need more smoke. In one particular moment, when we opened the ledger on the counter, it didn't open to where it was supposed to be. Jeff, who plays Lullaby and Xboxer, was sweeping leaves, and he actually moved across the line from inside the shop to outside the shop and was sweeping up leaves that were outside the shop. So there's these tiny technical things which an audience might not even notice, but it was really useful for me and the technical team to say, we need to put that right. The ringtone on the phone needs to be a different level, or whatever it is. So it was really that. I would never not have a dress rehearsal for those things. I mean, that was part of the technical rehearsal we had yesterday too. But that's stop and start. That's the difference for those listening who don't know that. You know, the technical rehearsal we had all day yesterday was literally every time there's a technical problem, you stop the action, freeze it, spool back a few moments and come back and do whatever needs to be done as a tweak on a light or moving something. Today was a run that was uninterrupted, but there are still technical issues to deal with. So that's what it was for me.
Final question. I'm going to leave the stinker till last, but I'm not sure I'll ever get a chance to ask this to anybody else. So four people go to see it tonight. Simon the playwright, Simon the director, Simon the novelist, and Simon the screenwriter. What would their different perspectives make of it, do you think? And would they all see themselves in it?
Wow. That's a tough question. There's also Simon the designer, and he's going to be in there too. I think all of them, what I said to the guys right at the outset with this work and with any work, for me it's always about clarity and truth. If you can make the work clear for the audience to understand what it is you're trying to say, this is a black comedy, but the subtext is about cultural imperialism. If we can have clarity and that can ring true in their performances, all of the above, whatever hat I was wearing, that's what I want to achieve with the piece.
I kind of want to just let the silence happen after that answer, but thank you very much, Simon.
It's been a great pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.